All right, so I'm here with Ian Vanek.
What's up?
Heidi. Doesn't work. Oh, it does work. Yeah.
Heidi Nielsen.
Hi.
And Zach Poff. So, as mentioned, I'm Galen Joseph Hunter. I'm executive director of Wave Farm, and I'm just going to start with a few minutes of a bit of introduction and history to offer some context for the works we're going to be discussing today by Ian, Heidi, and Zach. Wave Farm was originally founded in March 1997 as a micro radio artist collective in Brooklyn, New York, called Free 103.9. Micro radio was a term commonly used by unlicensed broadcasters in the mid-90s in conjunction with activism and advocacy that eventually in 2000 helped create this country's first low-power FM radio service called LPFM for short. For anyone who's not in radio or interested in being in radio, you may not know that unless you're a large corporate entity with upwards of six figures, prior to LPFM, it was impossible to get on your airwaves. So LPFM made licenses available to small community stations of 100 watts or less that were much more affordable. In the late 90s and early 2000s, Free 103.9 was also a venue for performance and experimental sound on South 6th Street in Williamsburg. And there, a community of artists emerged who thought conceptually about the transmission spectrum as a creative medium. These artists became invested in a hands-on relationship with airwaves. Micro radio wasn't simply a distribution device, but was rather a creative space and practice. And in response, in 2002, Free 103.9 evolved from artist collective to an arts organization established to define, cultivate, and foster transmission arts, which we describe as artists' experiments with broadcast media and the airwaves. Transmission art encompasses works in which the act of transmitting or receiving is not only significant, but the fulcrum for the artist's intention. The genre is more loosely defined as a multiplicity of practices that engage aural and visual broadcast media, where in some instances works for traditional broadcast are created, and at other times artists harness or create transmissions for manipulation in live performance, installation, and public interactive networks and tools. In 2005, organizational activities expanded upstate to Greene County. That's the aerial. Roughly 2.5 hours north of the city to facilitate an artist residency program, summer performance series, and long-term outdoor installations on a 29-acre property called Wave Farm, the organization name we use now today. Wave Farm programs remain committed to celebrating and providing access to transmission technologies and support artists and organizations that engage with media as an art form. Our three major programs are Transmission Arts, WGXC, and Media Art Grants. Our transmission art programs include the Wave Farm Residency Program, which fosters the creation of new transmission artworks and new scholarship in the genre. Each year, 10 artists are awarded residencies, which take place for 10 days between June and October. And the installations being presented here today were either conceived or created in conjunction with Wave Farm residencies. Online, the Wave Farm Transmission Art Archive presents a living genealogy of artists' experiments with broadcast media and the airwaves, and Wave Farm Radio is a site-specific broadcast of this material on 1620 AM on the property and a continuous online feed. The second major program of Wave Farm is the FM radio station WGXC. In 2007, during a rare filing window with the FCC for full power non-commercial educational stations, we submitted an application, and in 2011, we're finally able to go on air at 90.7 FM, transmitting 3,300 watts to over 78,000 potential listeners in the Upper Hudson Valley and international listeners online. The WGXC program schedule is extremely diverse. Community programs produced by local volunteers are offered Sunday through Friday, 6 a.m. through midnight, and the overnights and all-day Saturdays are devoted to transmission art and experimental sound. which is a pretty unprecedented commitment to the experimental on radio in the United States. And then our final program is a partnership with the New York State Council on the Arts called the Media Arts Assistance Fund, which provides funding through a regrant program to individual media artists throughout New York State and media arts organizations. And we also manage the Media Arts Map, which is an interactive Google Map and funding opportunities resource for the media arts in New York State. I'm delighted to be joined by Ian and Heidi and Zach today. I'm going to introduce each of them individually before they take the reins so that their info is fresh. We're going to start with Heidi. Wayfarm first worked with Heidi in 2014 when she was awarded a residency for Ground Station, a portable radio observation station employing amateur and ham radio technologies to witness and participate in space operations and exploration. And we've managed to find ways to continue working with Heidi on an annual basis since. In 2015, she led a transmitter hunt at a weekend-long festival in August called Lodge that we produce annually. And this year, we are very excited about her long-term installation, Outer Net Library Branch Wave Farm, which she's gonna tell you about. Heidi's an artist addressing topics such as weather, fake snow, and the cultural landscape of outer space. Her work, often collaborative and publishing-based, has been supported by the Art Matters Foundation, the Bronx Museum of Arts, the Center for Book Arts, the College Book Art Association, the Drawing Center, Wave Farm, Flux Factory, iPark, the International Print Center New York, the Islip Art Museum, the Queens Museum of Art, and many others. She is a member of the ABC Artist Book Cooperative. She founded SP Weather Station, and her work is included in over 60 museum and university collections. She was born in Oregon and received a BA in biology from Reed and an MFA in painting from Pratt, and lives and works in New York. Heidi.
Thank you. All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that all right?
That is still all right.
On this one?
Yeah.
Okay. So, can you hear me okay? Okay, good. So, hi everyone, and thanks Galen for the introduction and for having me. So, I came here to talk about two public projects which are in the works for the grounds of Wave Farm. But first, a little bit of background. As Galen was saying, I'm really interested in the way that we think about outer space as a landscape and how the outer space is, is continuous with our familiar landscapes. We interact with it all the time, like using GPS and telecommunications and so on. But because most of us can't see it or interact with it directly, it's an abstract thing that you have to sort of think about in order to understand it. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in how we can make it more, make that landscape more connected or present to us here on Earth. So I've been using radio as a method of detecting the landscape in that sense, and by interacting with satellites, for example, that are present in it. So, for example, this image shows one of a series of temporary installations that I'm developing now in South Florida, where I've created inflatable beach ball antennas, which, when installed on a beach and then connected to a radio dongle, and in this case also to a computer, I can receive transmissions from weather satellites. And the transmissions can be run through software, kind of like fax software, to be changed into images of Earth from the satellite above. So it's kind of like you're looking out across the ocean on the beach and then also seeing a view of your location from space above. And I'm designing a couple of different kinds of antennas that are inside the beach balls, and the beach balls need to be inflated in order for the antenna shape to happen. So the first project I'm proposing for Wave Farm, or one of them, is provisionally titled Vanguard 1 Transmitter Hunt. So in exploring transmissions as a means of detecting things, I've been researching a lot of ham radio activities. And one of the activities is a transmitter hunt. So this is a bunch of examples of people doing transmitter hunts. They're also called fox hunts or bunny hunts. And they're basically a hide-and-seek game, where one person hides a small transmitter, and then individuals or teams seek the transmitter using directional antennas and radios. And they're popular all over the world. The one on the lower left is in Indonesia, and there's a few other examples from the US. And they have lots of variations. So they can be played on foot or using, you know, over long distances using cars, and with different levels of sophistication. So experienced players can really understand how the radio waves are interacting with the landscape and can use that knowledge to find the transmitter more easily. Anyway, last summer at Wave Farm, there was an event called The Lodge where we made antennas and tried out our own transmitter hunt, and that's the center image there. And it was on the grounds of a resort in the Catskills. So I want to make this transmitter hunt for Wave Farm like a game, but I want to be able to connect it to not only about finding things here on Earth, but also connecting it to the space landscape. And so I've been really interested in space archaeology, meaning that the cultural heritage kind of angle on the things and the satellites that are in outer space now. So all the stuff that we've left on the moon, all the stuff that's in orbit around the sun, as well as the tons of stuff that's in orbit around the Earth now. So this image shows Vanguard 1, which is the oldest satellite still in Earth's orbit. It was launched in 1958, and it's expected to remain in orbit for hundreds of years. So the idea for the game for Wave Farm is a Vanguard 1 transmitter hunt. So the idea is that a game master of some sort would turn on a transmitter, which is inside a scale model of the Vanguard 1 satellite, and then hides it on the grounds of Wave Farm. So the players would receive antennas, a radio, and mission files, which would include a background on the satellite and also just images of it so they know what they're looking for. And the scenario of the game would be conveyed to the players. So here's the scenario. It is the year 2266. You are a crack team of space archaeologists specializing in early space age artifacts at a major Universal museum. The famous and coveted Vanguard 1, launched 250 years ago, has been the oldest satellite remaining in Earth's orbit until now. Its orbit decayed and it fell to Earth, and its crash landed on the grounds of Wave Farm. Somehow, the satellite is transmitting a signal, and you need to find it using the signal before space artifact looters get to it. So the game could be played with competing teams, which could be from different museums or different corporate collections or just different teams of looters or bandits or something. So that's one project that I'm working on that I'm planning on returning to later on in the summer. But the second project that I have to show you today is I'm going to build in June, and it's called the OuterNet Library Branch Wave Farm. So the OuterNet, if you don't know of it, this is just an image from the website. It's a new and separate system outside the internet, and it's an expanding library collection of data files that are broadcast from satellites in space, and so it has worldwide coverage. An OuterNet Library receive station collects transmissions and stores the files locally. In our case, on a Raspberry Pi, and allows them to be accessed by wireless devices in range of the station. So the OuterNet's been envisioned as an open, worldwide, collaborative platform where anyone can have a say in what's included. So the OuterNet Library Branch Wave Farm will be an outdoor area defined by a Wi-Fi signal, which is centered around a satellite dish on a pole and surrounded by seating, kind of like in this mock-up. This is an early mock-up of the idea. The dish receives a signal from Galaxy 19 satellite and connects to electronics under the seating and receives power from Wave Farm's Outpost 1, which is that box on the left. Also under the seating is the one and only physical book in the library. So a branch visitor, a library branch visitor, would step into the delineated library area, and which is the Wi-Fi signal, and if they like, they would take a seat. And then through the wireless on their cell phone or other device that they brought along, maybe a computer, they would be able to browse, read, and save materials from the library, kind of like the visitor is doing on the right, and that's the interface from the OuterNet system. Materials include books, audio, video, images, any kind of digital file, and the collection is growing and added to all the time. And visitors also can contribute, but they can suggest or provide materials for inclusion, which is a whole other angle on it. So the visitor on the left is viewing the one physical book at this library branch. It's called the library's book. And it's found underneath the bench in like a pelican case. That's the idea. And I'm developing it now. But since this whole endeavor is sort of about thinking about the future of libraries, I want the library's book to be kind of an open riff on that idea, so that somebody on a break from viewing their digital files that have been transmitted by satellite, they can also peruse the book and think about how libraries were in the past, so and how libraries are experienced and envisioned, so in the past, the present, and the future. So the examples that I'm going to have in the book are real libraries and real history, but also as well as fictional future visions. There's a, you know, it's a whole genre in itself. And this is an example of one that's from Star Trek Enterprise, season 2, episode 1, where Captain Archer and a temporal agent, Daniels, have found the ruins of a library while they're stranded on another planet in the 31st century. So it's just really, you know, this interesting like range of materials that think about how our future visions of past and libraries are. So anyway, that's my last slide. And thanks.
Thank you. Sam, are you gonna go up there, or are you gonna stay put? It's up
here.
Okay, so we first worked with Zach in 2009 when he was awarded a fellowship to create a piece called Radio Silence, an installation that explores the silent moments of talk radio, combining 8 broadcasts into a meta-conversation based on the negative spaces between words. That was installed in a gallery space in Brooklyn called Devotion, which no longer exists. Zach returned to Wave Farm in 2013 for a residency with collaborator N.B. Aldridge, where he conceived of the project he'll be talking about today. POF is a New York area digital media artist, educator, and maker of things. Through artwork, teaching, and free software creation, he examines the opportunities and challenges that arise from the translation of human activity into information. His recent work has been focused on the paradigm of broadcasting and its continued influence on the contemporary digital and social networks. He currently teaches sound art at Cooper Union in the city, and his installations, recordings, and performances have exhibited at Reveille, 60 by 60, Sonic Terrain, the Portland Museum of Art, ISEA 2008, which was in Singapore, Artist Space, and other venues worldwide.
Thanks. Okay, and I might need a hand at some point in here because I think the way my sound files are embedded, I might need a mouse click. I'm not sure if the presenter is going to do it. The little wireless
that little dongle thing is the mouse.
I see.
Good luck.
Thank you. So, what we're looking at here is Pond Station. Pond Station is a platform for monitoring the underwater life of a pond, which is on the Wave Farm property. So Pond Station is this solar-powered autonomous object. It's a floating sculpture. It's sitting there right now as we speak. And it has hydrophones in it, which are reaching down into the water. The hydrophones are underwater mics and are kind of half buried in the muck on the bottom of the pond. And so on a day when there's complete stillness, you know, windless day on the surface of the pond, everything seems quite quiet, but actually there's a really diverse underwater world that's being quite vocal underneath the surface. I'll go to the next slide. Yes, so there's supposed to be a little speaker icon in the corner of this, which is supposed to have the sound file linked to it. I don't know if that's there. All right, I'll hit next and see if it, there we go.
Thank you.
These are examples. Maybe we could turn it up a little.
It's underwater?
So these are maybe 5 or 6 clips strung together from different times of day, different times of year. And none of it's been manipulated electronically at all. Thank you. this one is during a rainstorm. These are all recorded in the same location. The hydrophones haven't moved, but at different times of the day, different times of the year, different seasons, different temperatures, different sounds occur. And so the sound we're hearing now is excerpted from the live stream that's on all the time, streaming right now as we speak, which you can get to from the WGXC website and also from my website. And one of the things that brought me into conversation with these sounds is a kind of long-term interest in art making that explores a sort of kind of authorship that's not completely individual. So I'm very interested in collaboration, both with people and also with the chants of the world, and also with all the different creatures who don't have any care for what I'm doing. Or know my language, and I don't really care to know theirs. But I'm very interested in how a lot of individual actors, when working together, in this case we've got probably air bubbles from the respiration of plants as they produce oxygen underwater, and a whole bunch of animals, insects, a lot of the sounds, there's a bullfrog. So, you know, the bullfrog, when recorded from underneath of the water, has a very different sound than above the water, because there's no acoustics in our traditional sense under the water. So we're hearing this sort of purring that's coming directly from the vibration of the frog, and we don't get the air sac that's above the water that echoes through. You know, so a lot of that rich, low voice of the frog that we're used to is something that only can be heard above the water. But below the water, it's a whole different thing going on. So back to how I got involved with this stuff. I really like phenomenon that emerge on their own from relatively simple beginnings to create extremely complex relationships. Whether that's polyrhythmic stuff, I mean, you can think of it musically, you can think of it biologically, and I wanted to put myself in a position as almost like a, not a translator necessarily, but someone who gives access. And radio is a wonderful way to give that kind of access. So by dipping these hydrophones down, I think the next slide is probably hydrophones, yeah. By dipping those hydrophones down into the water, we can bring up out of the water something that would basically stop if we stepped in there. So while I'm out there working on this project physically, if I set foot in that water, a lot of the sound that you just heard stops. My very existence in that space messes up the entire system and unbalances the whole system. So it took a little bit of engineering and a little bit of artistry to kind of bring all those sounds back up out of the water and give them to us all. So there's a web stream I'll explain it actually from the beginning to the end. The hydrophones, which you see pictures of up there, these are handmade hydrophones. They're made of relatively typical parts, pipe fittings, cables, things like that. They reach down into the water, and then above the water is this floating system with a bunch of handmade electronics in it that do preamplification and control of the audio signals that it receives. There's another stream of input that was added later to the system, which takes a little more explaining. While I was doing the initial residency that led to this work up at Wave Farm, I was experimenting with translating vibrations of light into vibrations of sound. And I had a little light sensor attached to the eyepiece of binoculars, and I was just out on the pond in the evening, kind of moving around with the binoculars, and I heard what sounded like a fly flying past my headphones. And then it sounded like 100 flies, and it sounded like mosquitoes, and there was all these things flying around. So I take the headphones off and it goes away. I put the headphones on its back, but I was not listening through any kind of microphones. I was strictly listening to light vibrations translated into sound. And it took a while to realize that what I was hearing in the headphones were the reflections of the sun off of the wings of insects. So as the insect would fly past the kind of image circle of the binoculars, you'd hear this, which is remarkably similar to the sound that you would hear if you were, you know, had a mic looking at that same thing. But a big difference there is the reach and the range. You know, so with something optical, you can look and compress a deep distance. So there might be 10,000 insects in your view optically, whereas there would only be 10 or 20 if you were putting up a mic. You know, the mic only hears what's around it locally, but the lenses on the binoculars can compress and look deep into the distance. So I decided to incorporate that also into Pond Station, because really Pond Station's about translation, giving access to things that we wouldn't be able to access with our regular bodies. You know, you can't hear very well underwater, and you certainly can't hear visual things. So there are now lights added to this thing. That's a picture of the receiving station, actually. There's a microcontroller, an Arduino, inside the Pond Station transmitter, which relays all of its information about its battery health. It's battery powered, solar charged, completely autonomous, and all of the decisions about when to turn on, when to turn off, they all happen based on its little internal microcontroller, and that stuff is also relayed to this sort of base station. There's a Raspberry Pi there that generates the web stream, which you can access online anytime the sun is shining, basically. And that information also goes out online as a sort of telemetry dashboard. So in this case, what we're seeing is the sunlight strength, 97%, and then a graph of sunlight over time. So you can see most of one day and then nighttime, and the beginning of the next day. So the system turns on in the morning when it gets enough light, transmits for the day, then it switches at night over to the light mode. It has lights on it, which we'll see in a moment, that turn on, and those lights attract the insects and provide a source of illumination for the bounce to occur, the visual bounce that comes back into the light sensors. So there it is, all lit up at night, and it hasn't gotten buggy yet enough to really hear anything, so I'm playing here a recording that I recorded through binoculars. I think it sounds all like speech. Some kind of like paranormal investigators in here realize it's actually the voices of the dead.
No. Do you sleep well?
So when it gets warmer, if you tune in just after dark, you should hear stuff like this. Or you could hear anyone who's got any flashing lights that happens to be walking by this thing as it's installed in the pond. Because another aspect of it is that since the wave farm has this constantly changing cast of characters coming through, you know, as I was one, residents come by, visitors come by, it's open on certain weekends for average folks to come in and see this stuff, listen to this stuff. If you walked by with some sort of flashing light, you know, bike lights or something, you would hear all kinds of clicks. Any kind of light that has a dimmer of any kind on it usually has a very characteristic kind of buzzing noise if it were sonified. And any of those kind of sounds would be something that this could receive if you're facing the right direction. I also want to talk a little bit in the last couple seconds here about the challenges of long-term unattended installations on water 3 hours away and when you don't have a car. It's been through a couple iterations. Galen has been nice enough to fish it out of the pond once when this happened. So far, I lay the blame on adding a little too much weight and possibly turtles. The resident turtles at the wave farm make a lot of rendezvous by crawling onto the styrofoam pontoons that hold the thing up and keep it from diving into the water. And so one morning it did this. So since then it's been refurbished, dried out, and it's a little more floaty than it used to be. So we hope that this doesn't happen again. But back to the idea of like a sort of collaboration both with the undersea creatures themselves, underwater creatures themselves, and with humans. There's also, because this web stream is running all the time, it's accessible not only to people who visit the property, but people around the world. So it was just used as part of Reveille, which is a worldwide web streaming event that just happened last week. And Reveille is organized in the UK, and it's a 24-hour web audio stream that's made up of little half-hour-long chunks of people streaming the sound of daybreak in their time zone. So you can imagine as the sun goes around the Earth, different parts of the Earth are kind of waking up at different times. And so what's happening is they're kind of surfing this wave of sunlight as it goes across the entire circumference of the Earth, and they're patching together this never-ending dawn. It's amazing. And so we used Pond Station as the stream for this kind of time zone. And so people all around the world got to hear whatever was going on in the pond at 5:30 in the morning the other day. And then it transitioned from that to somebody in, I think, in Brooklyn with mics hanging out their window. And it transitioned from that to somebody, 100 miles further to the west. And it goes around and around and around. And also, this last little part, I'll just play an excerpt of this before we move on to Ian's, is a person, I'm actually forgetting his name, the duet with Shakuhachi.
Jeffrey Levendorf.
Thank you. Who was listening to the stream of Pond Station and playing along. Longer than this, but I'll hand it over to you.
Thanks, Seth. All right, Ian.
Yeah.
back in Williamsburg at the 31329 project space, in 2001 was when we first started working with Ian. Vis-a-vis his collaboration with Matt Riley, the art project called Japanther, that they started while attending Pratt. Japanther for how many years? 13, 14?
Something like that.
Collaborated with a massive list of notable artists, making a name for themselves in unique performance situations. They were featured in the 2006 Whitney Biennial as part of the Don't Trust Anyone Over 30 puppet rock opera in collaboration with Dan Graham. And today, Ian lives and works in New York and travels much of the year with his band Howardian. Vanek's drawings, paintings, printmaking, and performance surround a fascination with architecture, machinery, and imaginary cityscapes. The result is a body of work with amorous joy, wild abandon, and childish curiosity.
Right off the website.
That's right.
So Galen touched on this earlier, but there was a group of artists in 2001, 2002 on South 6th Street in Williamsburg around a pirate radio station called Free 103.9. And we all felt very strongly that we just felt like a tight-knit community of people. And since then, we're now 15 years in the future, and we're still collaborating, and we're still friends, so I feel really strongly about that. I would also mention that I'm much more mystical than some of these very defined projects that we've talked about. We wanted to create a space that was an outpost. The furthest reaches of the wave farm have a wrong direction. Yeah, I made this thing, it's sunk. No, I'm just kidding. So, Oh, here you see some of our collaborations. I guess I sent this to Galen. This is us in the Venice Biennial. We did a performance for almost 90 hours once. We started a free restaurant. We played with some synchronized swimmers. There you see my friend Skylar's beautiful ass. He's a really beautiful man. Climbing a 40-foot tower we built. There's some other things we've had some fun over the years. So at the Wave Farm, they asked us, what do you want to do? And we said, well, we'd really like to blend nature with technology and broadcast. We want to make a hideout. We want to make a space on your property where you can hide from everyone and still make a recording. So these are some of the early inspiration drawings, like a lean-to idea, a house in the woods. And this is us being a little bit silly while we're having our residency, envisioning what we might look like when we're standing in the space. Here's us sweating over the space with Gardner and Jason, two of our assistants who are integral in the project. This is a process picture of us. So we worked much like the 100 Years of Solitude. We spent time on the land and said, this is where the house should be. So it took a long time to find the actual space. And again, not working with technology, working with the sun and working with things like wrenches, like very simple technology. This is the telephone that inhabits the space. When you pick up the receiver, you're able to record your conversation. So the outpost functions essentially as a confessional. So you can be in the middle of the woods and you can tell them that you've cheated on your wife and murdered three people, and no one will ever know who did the recording. So then this is just kind of a detail of the space. And it's called the Remote Audio Outpost, and what it is a confessional in the woods on the Wave Farm where these other beautiful, strange projects exist. So you find yourself at the end of the trail and you say, oh, here's a little cabin for me to sit down in. And there's a telephone, you pick it up, and you're not sure what happens, except for that you're being recorded. And, you know, the Hobbit door was important to me, the red door. And this is Creativity Tech Week, and hashtags are important in your life. Any questions?
Did you have recordings from any department?
Oh, do we?
The sound samples? Do
What do you know what slide it was on? This one maybe? No?
Yeah.
I had some recordings. It's essentially people just being silly in the woods because it's like a childish space, like I said, more mystical. Like the idea of being an artist but not having defined corners to your work, and the idea of being in a space where you can say almost anything. And again, childish. She mentioned the word childish and amorous joy. I think that artwork and technology is essentially so boring that I want to fall asleep most of the time. And that mysticism is really important. And that the cave cults, and we've created our own cave to start a mystic religion, or not even religion, just start a mystic idea. You know, and I think that the internet is a mystic idea, that sonification is a mystic idea, and of course space is a mystic idea that Heidi brings up, you know, and of course Galen is on a mystic journey bringing all these crazy artists together. But then we have to do things in our day-to-day that are much more defined, and that's where I start to fall asleep, is when you become an adult, I start to fall asleep. So we've created a mystic cave for children to be children. And our group is called Japan There. My name is Ian Vanek. I see some questions here.
I was going to say that the audio is on the picture of the telephone.
That's what I thought, yeah. Then I clicked it on that one.
Yeah, just wait. Don't click
on it. Oh, is it autoplay?
Is that auto-playing, or if you click again once? I'm looking.
I'm like,
out
of the door.
So this is someone just being weird in the mystical cave. Of course, it's low-fi.
I'm going to look at who's looking in. The woman from Berlin.
But it's a woman from Berlin and a man.
Goodbye for now.
Yeah. Kind of doing their confession. And some other people just kind of confused by it, they say. So I love it. It's joyous, it's amorous, it's childish. And those are important parts of, I guess, what you would call my work, but I don't want to call anything work because of what you're playing. It's the idea that, like, telephones create really good recordings, and I love telephones for some reason. So I'm making a beat for you. So they're confessions, you know, like, they're secret recordings. See, this is perfect. That's a real child knowing how to play with the technology.
Get on my track.
That's actually a perfect 4-year-old knows how to use it better than.
Hello.
See, they don't know what to do. The 4-year-old knew right what to do.
That's. I'm saying nothing.